Kaplan in New York. Now we return to Rebecca Davis in Washington with today's other international news.
While negotiations resume this afternoon to bring down the Indian barricades at Oka outside Montreal, the peaceful dismantling of the Ganawage blockades by the Canadian Army has begun. The Canadian Army surrounded the barricades yesterday and forced a solution, at least for now. Dan Rosenberg has this report.
Thanks to a dramatic gentleman's agreement between Army Lieutenant Colonel Robin Gagnon and members of the Warrior Society, the Ganawake barricades are indeed being taken down peacefully in a cooperative move by the military and the Mohawks. This military agreement is separate from negotiations currently taking place in Dorval, Quebec. Gagnon, at a press conference outside the Army Press Center in Chateauguay, said today he has no control over when the blockades are removed in Oka. The Kanisataki natives there are reportedly asking for protection from reprisals before they agree to give up their stronghold. They are also seeking an amendment to the Police Act, which would guarantee politicians control over provincial police. Gagnon shrugged off suggestions that he is a hero for accomplishing his mission without gunfire. "I'm not a hero at all," he said. "This is the result of several thousand men being deployed around the Ganawake area. It is not a one-man show." Gagnon emphasized he does not consider the Mohawks' passiveness a surrender. "It's a military deal," he said. "There have been no arrests or confiscating of weapons because I've encountered no people carrying weapons in front of me. If that happens, then I'll arrest them." Preliminary predictions were that the Mercer Bridge linking Chateauguay to Montreal would reopen by Labor Day. Captain Richard St. Louis of the Army Media Center said that military engineers will check to make sure the access roads and bridge are safe before motorists would be allowed to proceed. But first, huge anti-tank ditches 20 feet wide and 10 feet deep would have to be filled in by the Army and Mohawks. Meanwhile, Quebec Public Security Minister Sam Elkis promised that rock-throwing hooligans who impeded the departure of evacuees from Ganawage on Tuesday will be arrested and prosecuted. 7 members in a 60-car Mohawk caravan were injured in that ugly incident. Chateauguay Mayor Bosco Bourchier was in Quebec City today and could not be reached for comment. Before leaving, he told reporters that the blockade was the saddest event to happen to Chateauguay since the historic Battle of Chateauguay in 1813. Dan Rosenberg, Pacifica News, Chateauguay, Quebec.
What could turn out to be a precedent-setting decision has been handed down by an immigration judge in Washington, D.C. The federal judge has told the Immigration and Naturalization Service that it cannot order 3 Salvadorans back to their country as long as the civil war continues. William Van Wyk, the attorney for the refugees, says this is the first case in which an immigration judge has allowed a refugee to remain because of war in another country. This is different from the usual case in which a person has to prove individual persecution if he or she would return.
In fact, in this case, the judge said they have not proved that they're going to be individually persecuted, but nonetheless, they have proved that they're fleeing from war, and the murder, rape, and destruction of war, as he said, and on account of our obligation to respect international law and his obligation to apply international law in the deportation proceedings, he said they shall not be deported to El Salvador.
This decision allows Maria Elena Santos, her mother and small child, to stay in the United States until the civil war in El Salvador is over. Van Wyk says this decision should be helpful to the thousands of Salvadorans who apply for asylum status in this country but are refused. Last year, the INS granted asylum to only 3% of those applying who had fled El Salvador. The INS has until September the 6th to decide whether to appeal the judge's ruling. Attorney Van Wyk says an appeal is likely because the ruling is contrary to a decade of federal immigration policy. After weeks of military stalemate and countless tribal killings, a 2,500-member peacekeeping force has been sent into strife-torn Liberia. The troops' mission is to enforce a ceasefire in the country's 8-month civil war. Richard Nyberg has this report from the Ivory Coast.
The force, consisting of troops from Nigeria, Ghana, the Gambia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, was organized by the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. Led by Ghanaian Commander Arnold Kwenu, the troops today were consolidating their position around the Monrovia port, where they landed at the weekend. few details of fighting have emerged in recent days, but the African peacekeeping troops encountered resistance from rebels of the National Patriotic Front of Liberia on Saturday. The rebels, led by former government official Charles Taylor, have called on the ECOWAS troops to pull out. The NPFL rebels now control all of Liberia except for the port area and central Monrovia, where beleaguered President Doe is holed up with about 500 members of the elite presidential guard. Most troops loyal to Doe are from his Kron tribe, while nearly all of the rebels are from the rival Gio and Mano groups. In Banjul, the Gambia, meanwhile, numerous Liberian politicians and religious leaders were meeting today to try to lay groundwork for an interim government and elections in the West African states. The talks got underway this week despite the absence of President Doe and Taylor. But dissident rebel leader Prince Johnson, who has agreed to an informal truce with the Doe forces and who has welcomed the African peacekeeping troops, has sent a delegation to the conference. So far, the Liberians have agreed that Doe must step down to pave the way for presidential elections. They were expected to name an interim leader soon. But with thousands of armed rebels opposing peacekeeping troops and no indication that Doe will leave office, the Liberian crisis seems set to drag on for weeks. For Pacifica News in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, this is Richard Nyberg.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Julie Cohen in New York with Rebecca Davis in Washington. Brooklyn activist Vander Beatty, a former state senator and congressional candidate trying to make a political comeback, was shot in the head and killed today in his Democratic campaign headquarters. Beatty was shot down about 1:30 in the afternoon in the banner-draped converted bar and died a short time later at Brooklyn Jewish Hospital. Police are searching for a man who is reported to have fled the office just after the shooting. Beatty was once a Brooklyn political powerhouse and leading black activist, but was brought down by a long criminal investigation. He served two prison terms and had only recently been released. He left his state Senate post in 1982 to make an ill-fated run for the U.S. House seat being vacated by longtime Representative Shirley Chisholm. Earlier today, an assistant district attorney was slain outside a food store in a drive-by shooting near the Bronx Court building where he worked. The prosecutor, Sean Healy, was shot at least once in the head by a gunman in a passing car. He was declared dead on arrival at Lincoln Hospital. Rikers corrections officers used excessive force to put down a mid-August riot at Rikers Island, this according to the New York State Commission of Correction. Meanwhile, some members of the Corrections Officers Union will be picketing for the removal of the head of that union, Philip Selig. WBAI's William Hollister reports on both developments.
Over 100 inmates and guards were injured in the Rikers melee and corrections officer strike 2 weeks ago. Prison guards had argued they had beat the inmates in self-defense to control a riot. But according to a statement on the August 14th incident issued by the New York State Commission of Correction, this isn't the whole story. The statement says in many cases it was the inmates who acted in self-defense. Stephen Del Jaco is a spokesperson for the commission.
We've looked at medical records which document a number of fractures, multiple fractures, other injuries sustained by inmates, which lead us to conclude that a fairly large number of inmates suffered defensive wounds. In other words, they were hit trying to protect themselves, and that a number of them, in fact, were struck from behind. We believe that evidence and the large number of inmate injuries and the severity of those injuries really offers to us conclusive evidence that the force that was used by officers was far in excess of what was necessary to control the inmates and to protect themselves.
This information affirms what many Rikers inmates and their attorneys have been saying for a while. John Boston is a staff attorney at the Prisoners' Rights Project at the Legal Aid Society.
There was, in fact, massive retaliation and brutality by officers that was not justified by the misconduct that the inmates engaged in. And in fact, it was meted out to many inmates who had engaged in no misconduct whatsoever. As far as we can tell, this is about the most massive instance of officer misconduct and brutality that has ever happened in the New York City jail system.
Boston says the August 14th melee is the culmination of a system that has been getting progressively more and more violent over a number of years and seems out of control.
And the disturbing thing is that it's not just the inmates who are out of control. This is something that we hear fairly frequently, but that the staff themselves, the supposed law enforcement officers of Rikers Island, that are out of control and engaging in overtly illegal activity.
The New York City Department of Corrections could not be reached for comment. Ironically, the statement of excessive force comes as a federal district court judge upholds the right of officers to use deadly force to defend themselves against prisoners. Boston says the regulations are really nothing new. He says they simply ratify an agreement between the Legal Aid Society and the Department of Corrections.
On some level, it was sort of a tempest in a teapot because the Department of Correction claimed that it was never trying to change the policy, it was just trying to make it clearer. And everybody agrees that what we came out with is not a changed policy, that it still maintains all the essential restrictions against the misuse of force by correctional officers, but it's shorter and more understandable to the ordinary person.
However, Phil Selig, who is president of the Correction Officers Benevolent Association, says he still has some reservations and will appeal the ruling on several technicalities. Meanwhile, some members of the Correction Officers Union are calling for Selig's ouster. On a stormy meeting Wednesday night, black correction officers, members of the Guardians Association, said they would petition for the removal of Selig. The Guardians Association charges that Selig has shown a pattern of subtle racism. Last week, it was reported that Selig insinuated that Mayor David Dinkins' race affected his ability to deal with the Rikers melee. Selig says he was misrepresented. He says it is simply a management labor issue. He suggests Dinkins is using the predominantly black labor to bust the union he represents. The association says in addition to the racially insensitive comments, Selig has not retained any black law firms or medical officials for the union. Also, they say Selig, who is white, does not represent the union membership, which is mostly black. The Guardian Association says if Selig doesn't resign in 2 weeks, the group will file a federal lawsuit against the union charging racial discrimination. For WBAI News, I'm William Hollister.
New York City officials are alleging there's a major discrepancy in the new census data. According to rough figures released by the Census Bureau, the population of New York State rose by less than half a percentage point. The figure showed the population of New York City actually decreasing since 1980. This data is disputed by many experts and community leaders who point to the dangerous impact these inaccuracies may have. Devika Dayal has this report.
Many demographic experts are shocked by this year's census figures.
I think it badly underestimates the amount of people in New York City, so it doesn't really give us it doesn't really give you a good picture of how many people are here and what kinds of people are here.
Professor Emmanuel Tobia at NYU's Robert Wagner School of Public Service says, contrary to the census figure of about 7 million, his estimate for New York City is close to 8 million. Professor Tobia says this discrepancy will worst affect the city's lower income groups and already poorly represented groups. We spoke to many community leaders who agree with that analysis.
Councilman Wendell Foster represents the 9th District in the South Bronx. Poor communities like the South Bronx, in the poorest area in the whole United States of America, is going to be severely affected. We get our educational dollars as a result of the census. We get other social service money as a result of the census. And that we cannot afford. We just cannot afford to be adversely affected educationally. We suffer already. Many of the young people coming out of school cannot read and write, and I attribute a great deal of the crime to the fact that young people can't read and write, but they can sell dope without knowing how to read and write. So that's the way it's going to affect us in every way. The quality of life, the fact that you're going to lose representation in government when actually you need more representation in this community in government.
Okay, my name is Stanley Mark. I'm Program Director at Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and we feel that this undercount hurts all minorities and also Asian Americans. And we have all the services that are usually available for a poor immigrant community, and that would include, you know, bilingual services from, you know, including health and social services, etc. So I think that that's a pretty dramatic impact.
Hey, my name is Gilbert Banks, and I'm from Holland Fightback. We've been in Holland for 27 years. We have just received some information that New York City generates $89 billion in general revenue and only gets back $6 billion, and I'm sure that that kind of problem in terms of money comes from the fact that there is no representation based upon the census taking. That means that we don't get the services that New York City has to have in terms of rebuilding up the infrastructure, which has been destroyed by years and years of neglect.
To the rebroadcast of the WBAI News over WBAI, New York. Well, a very good evening to everybody. This is Emmanuel Goldstein. The program is The Fifth Corner, and we alternate here every other Thursday night with Andrew Phillips. And where have I been the last month or so? Well, one of the places I was Mexico. That's where this tape came from, straight from the heart of Mexico. And what an amazing place it was. Just be driving down desert highways that seemingly have no end to them. Very peaceful kind of a atmosphere to be in. But then, one day, early in the month, I turned on the radio. And I listened to a radio station that was coming from the United States, and that's the first time I heard the age-old phrase, "Get your filthy hands off my desert," yet again. And Mexico faded away.
A cruiser with all her hands, apparently to make him give it back.
Sean, I don't approve of dictators any more than you do. But if supporting dictators helps to keep the free world free, we'll support them.
Expediency.
Well, we're not going to sit by and be spectators to a communist takeover in this country.
What communist takeover? America's putting the guns and tanks into this country. America's building that damn military road.
I told you, De Jong, it's not military.
They're forced, Quensai, to prove it for my people. Take your guns and tanks away from him.
The minute we take our guns and tanks out of here, there'll be a vacuum that the communists will jump into faster than Hitler took Poland.
Now, who's spouting slogans? Where do you think you are, little rat? And who do you think I am, your little bum brother?
No. I'll tell you who I think you are. I think you're a dangerously misinformed man with a sinister notion about what the United States stands for.
This is sarcasm, not the United States. We don't get down our knees to the stars and stripes here.
Mm-hmm. You cheap, twisted ingrate. I am damn proud of the Stars and Stripes, and they've been pretty good to you. Who do you think's been buying your groceries for the past 7 years? I'm not talking about the United States government. I'm talking about the American people. From Boise, Idaho, and Moline, Illinois, people that have contributed millions of dollars out of their own pockets to Project Hope, to the care packages sent all over the world to people like you.
You can't buy gratitude with your handouts.
We don't need your gratitude. And we don't want you down on your knees to us or to Russia or to Red China either.
Don't preach at me. I'm not your pupil anymore.
I'm warning you, DeYoung, for the last time, you better listen.
I will not listen to your garbage anymore. This is not your country. It's mine.
You're a Judas coat. And you're leading your people right straight to the slaughterhouse.
Now, you listen. You wouldn't care about us if the Cold War didn't exist. Millions of us know it. Wherever you've exploited us, cheated us, abandoned us to tyrants like Frensai. Wherever black or brown or yellow men can read the newspapers and know
the hand out of my face.
You are democracies of fraud. It's for white people only.
I warn you. If we have to die again, we will die again. If we have to kill you, we will kill you.
But we won't let the Yankee imperialist bastards tell us what to do.
Not to be taller.
5 past 11.
There is a road.
I've always wanted to do that. I've always wanted to play that song just as it turned 55 minutes past 11 in the literal sense. But in the figurative sense, it's 55 past 11 and getting all the closer to midnight. We've got a lot of things to talk about tonight. We'll be inviting your calls a little bit later on. The program is The Fifth Corner. This is Emmanuel Goldstein, and as you know, I like to play with technology quite a bit, and I've been playing with both my shortwave radio and my telephone in attempts to get different angles on this whole MIDI situation. Intriguing, I'll say that, although it is a dangerous situation nonetheless. One thing that I was able to uncover, and this was by playing with some old tapes, I found an interesting series of reports that came out of an organization known as Audio Features Incorporated. This was something back from 1981. So let's all take a trip down memory lane and see if anything has really changed.
The administration's plans to sell 5 surveillance aircraft, AWACS, and other military equipment to Saudi Arabia is opposed by the director of the Center for Defense Information, Rear Admiral Jean LaRocque. The admiral, who served 7 years in the Pentagon as strategic planner, says the deal will not benefit the United States.
The sale of $8.5 billion of... serve the U.S. strategic interests in that area. It'll destabilize the area, makes war more likely in that area, and certainly is not in the interest of the United States.
Admiral LaRocque warns that the instability of the Saudi kingdom could result in the AWACS falling into the wrong hands, and LaRocque believes Saudi use of the planes will not be for defense.
Now, I see it as a real threat to the security and safety of the state of Israel, and not something that could be argued as a defensive weapon against a Soviet attack or against attack from Yemen or Oman or some other country in the region.
The sale of the AWACS, the surveillance planes, to Saudi Arabia will take place unless both houses of Congress vote against the deal by October 30th. This is Bob Gibson.
It's 1 hour Greenwich Mean Time, and here is the news from the Voice of America. I'm Ross Carpenter in Washington. Preparations are underway to evacuate women and children hostages from Iraq and Kuwait. But the United States says Iraq is complicating matters by imposing new restrictions on those seeking to leave. News reports say Iraq has moved at least 100 Western women and children from strategic installations around the country to a Baghdad hotel in preparation for their departure. Officials in London say Iraq has given permission for a British-owned Virgin Atlantic airliner to fly to Baghdad Friday to evacuate 140 hostages. Britain's Foreign Office says Iraqi authorities are also arranging for the possible evacuation of 132 British women and children to be flown on an Iraqi Airways jet from Baghdad to London, but there has been no word on when that flight might depart. The United States has complained that Iraq's promises to free women and children have been complicated by new restrictions, and no Americans had yet been released.
The Iraqis have now imposed additional demands on those wishing to depart. For example, they are now demanding that a letter from each American be written stating that they want to depart, a translation of that letter into Arabic, and a stamp on the letter by unspecified, quote, appropriate fiscal authorities to show that all Iraqi taxes have been paid. We hesitate to dignify these demands as, quote, exit procedures, end quote, because they are constantly changing and extremely confusing.
State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler. Meanwhile, President Bush says the United States is asking its allies to help pay the costs of the U.S. military deployment in the Persian Gulf, as well as provide economic assistance to countries that have been hard hit by the U.N. economic sanctions against Iraq. U.N. Secretary General Javier Pérez de Cuellar is to discuss the Gulf crisis in Jordan Friday with Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz. The U.N. chief says he will listen to what Iraq has to say and will urge Baghdad to comply with a U.N. resolution demanding an immediate Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait. Cairo was the setting for an Arab League meeting Thursday aimed at reducing tensions over the Gulf crisis. An Egyptian foreign ministry official said a six-nation committee has been formed to assess recent Arab initiatives to negotiate a settlement to the crisis. A draft resolution on the issue is expected to be presented at a second emergency session Friday evening. U.S. Navy ships in the Middle East are stepping up enforcement of U.N. trade sanctions against Iraq. VOA correspondent Art Charles says the latest action is in the Red Sea.
Some 250 ships have been intercepted, but only a few have actually been boarded. In the past 2 days, U.S. sailors have boarded four vessels and turned back one of the ships registered in Sri Lanka after it was found to have a prohibited cargo bound for Iraq. No Iraqi or Kuwaiti vessels have been boarded during what the U.S. military is calling Operation Desert Shield. Just 2 days ago, the Pentagon said the number of ships intercepted was 170. Now the number is 250, but spokesman Pete Williams characterized it only as a steady increase.
It's a function of more ships in the area. I can't give you all the reasons that it's gone up. I don't think it's a significant, I don't think it's a huge jump, in other words.
The Pentagon also announced the activation of several additional reserve units, including an Air Force squadron from Texas, some of whose members were among the 13 people killed in the crash Wednesday of a C-5A cargo plane at a U.S. air base in West Germany. Art Chimes, VOA News, the Defense Department.
Now when I was a young man, I carried my pack, and I lived a free life of the rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time to stop rambling. There's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun. And they sent me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as the ship pulled away from the quay. And amid all the tears, flag waving and cheers, we sailed off for Galilee. Well, I remember that terrible day when
and our blood stained the sand and the water. And how, in that hell that they called Suvla Bay, we were butchered like lambs of the slaughter. Johnny Turk, he was ready, oh, he primed himself well. He rained us with bullets, and he showered us with shell. And in 5 minutes flat, we were all blown to hell. Nearly blew us back home to Australia. And the band played Waltzing Matilda. When we stopped to bury our slain, and we buried ours, and the Turks buried theirs, then it started all over again. Those who were living just tried to survive in that mad world of blood, death, and fire. And for 10 weary weeks I kept myself alive, though around me the corpses piled higher. Then a big turkey shell knocked me arse overhead. And when I awoke in me hospital bed and saw what it had done, and I wished I were dead. Never knew there were worse things than dying. For no more I'll go waltzing Matilda, all around the green bush far and near. For to hump tent and pace, a man needs both legs. No more waltzing Matilda for me. They collected the wounded, the crippled, the maimed, and they shipped us back home to Australia. The armless, the legless, the blind, the insane, those proud, wounded heroes of Suvla. And when the ship pulled into Circular Quay, I looked at the place where my legs used to be, and thank Christ, there was no one there waiting for me. To grieve and to mourn and to pity. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as they carried us down the gangway. Nobody cheered, they just stood there and stared, and they turned all their faces. Oh, now, every April, I sit on my porch, and I watch the parade pass before me. And I see my old comrades, how proudly they march, renewing their dreams of past glory. I see the old men, all tired, stiff and sore, the weary old heroes of a forgotten war. And the young people ask, what are they marching for? And I ask myself the same question. And the band plays Waltzing Matilda, and the old men still answer the call. But year after year, the number get fewer. Someday no one will march there at all. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, who'll come a waltzing Matilda for me? And their ghosts may be heard, they march by the billabong. Who'll come a waltzing with me?
after all the marching and the brave talk and the excitement ends, that's when the really horrible stuff begins. And we all hope that that's something that people consider. There's been a remarkable lack of that in this particular case, and I'm not saying that what's going on over there isn't a bad situation. It certainly is when one country invades another country. I mean, we've seen it over here in this hemisphere quite a bit, haven't we? It's not a very good thing. It should not be tolerated, but one has to wonder when 250,000 troops are said to be preparing to mass in a foreign land. What's going to happen? Everyone is saying we're going to be there a long time. You know, it's going to be the next Vietnam, the sequel to Vietnam. All you people that feel cheated for not having been a part of that, well, this is your chance. And yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. You know, you've been watching films and seeing all the glory of war, but there's a lot of misery to war, and it doesn't just end on the battlefront. It comes right back here. Affects every last one of us. And I only hope that that doesn't get proven to be right, you know, because it happens so much in the future. I mean, I'm sorry, in the past. I guess I'm speaking some kind of prophecy in mind. But yeah, it's going to happen in the future, I'm sure. Will it happen in this particular case? Nobody really knows. Although a lot of people seem to want it to. A lot of people seem to want us to go to war over this what I think is a rather stupid situation. It really is an incredibly stupid situation, now that I think of it. It's a conflict that has been going on, actually, for quite some time, as most conflicts do. But for some reason, as always, we're the only ones that can go over there and make peace. Well, there's a lot we can be doing back here at home. One thing, in today's New York Times, leaders of the largest Arab American civil rights group said today that President Bush and other members of the administration had inadvertently fostered an atmosphere of animosity toward Americans of Arab descent by using heated oratory directed at President Saddam Hussein of Iraq. That assertion by leaders of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee came at a news conference where the group circulated a list it had drawn up detailing threats and attacks against Arab Americans since Iraq invaded Kuwait 4 weeks ago. You know, it's interesting. I went around asking a couple of people as part of a sort of an informal poll of my own whether or not they thought that the Saudis would be any match for the Americans, and I asked three people, and all three of them said, "No way, we're going to kick their asses. The Saudis are on our side, for God's sake. Aren't they supposed to be?" Of course, if you listen to the reports that I dug up from the closet 10 years ago, you'd never guess that the Saudis are supposed to be our friends. And probably back then, Iraq was our friend. And 10 years from now, Iraq will be our friend, and Iran will be over for dinner, and the Saudis will be the enemies. It's just a never-ending carnival, it seems, of ridiculous squabbles and rhetoric and that kind of thing. Anyway, to continue with the matter here at home, the committee condemned Iraq's detention of foreign nationals and announced plans for a petition drive among Arab Americans aimed at persuading Baghdad to end that practice. The group's criticism of the language used by the president and other administration officials comes not long after Mr. Bush, explaining the American military presence in Saudi Arabia, compared the Iraqi leader to Hitler. Citing such language, Abdin Jabara, the organization's president, said George Bush set the tone in his Let's Get Tough speech, where he compared what happened in the Gulf to what happened in Europe in the 1930s. I think that was clearly a message that he was using to help build up public support. But he inadvertently helped to increase Saddam's popularity in the Middle East and make anti-Arab sentiment in this country more kosher, so to speak. James Abarizek, a former senator from South Dakota who is now the organization's chairman, said Mr. Bush has total command of the media and could use his position to draw a clear distinction between what he termed Iraqi military aggression and the law-abiding activities of Arab Americans. It would be a very easy thing for him to do, Mr. Abarczyk said. The committee's leaders were also critical of Margaret Tutwiler, the chief spokeswoman at the State Department, although they cited no specific remarks of hers. Just her overall attitude, I guess. The State Department said tonight, actually that was last night, that it would have no comment. At the White House, a spokesman, Roman Papadiouk, said, "We have not seen the remarks from the committee and therefore cannot comment on them." The committee also said it planned to gather Arab Americans' signatures on petitions calling on Mr. Hussein to release all foreign nationals being held against their will. Mr. Abarczyk said he would travel to Baghdad to present the petitions to the Iraqi president. "We're an organization dedicated to combating the negative images and stereotyping of Arab Americans and Arabs in all respects of American popular culture. The taking of innocent hostages and denying free exit to foreign nationals in these countries is not only wrong, but will have a negative impact on Arab Americans here," those comments from Mr. Jabara. The news conference comes at a time when the committee and other Arab American groups say there has been a sharp rise in hostility toward the estimated 2.5 million Americans of Arab descent. Today, the organization released what it called a representative list of 19 incidents this month in which Arab Americans had been physically attacked, verbally threatened, or subjected to racist or insensitive remarks by radio disc jockeys and talk show hosts. Spokesman for the committee played tape recordings of obscene telephone messages received at the group's office in Santa Ana, California, and made to an unidentified Arab American in Columbus, Ohio. In the call to the California office, an anonymous male suggested a soap opera about Arab Americans that depicts people with prayer rugs in the street, camels walking around, hold-up men, and Arab prostitutes with their faces covered. In language laced with profanity, the caller in Ohio referred to the Arab American receiving the call as a towel head and told him that he should, quote, "keep an eye out, watch behind your back, you're the next hostage," unquote, using an expletive before the word hostage. At the news conference, Mr. Jabara said, "If this type of thing is going to happen now, what will happen if there is a shooting war over there in the Gulf?" An article written by Stephen Holmes, Thursday's New York Times, entitled "Arab Americans Faulting Bush on Hostility." So it has a lot of backlash, you know. I mean, we go over there and go to save the oil fields. Not even our oil fields. I mean, we haven't bought the oil yet, you know. Can you imagine if we suddenly decided to, let's say the farmers finally got fed up with the way they're treated and they stopped growing crops and the rest of the world got all upset because we weren't selling them crops like we used to, you know? Can you imagine them coming over here and saying, well, you know, we're going to protect these farm fields because they're destined for the rest of the world? I'm not justifying what's happening over there. I'm not justifying the atrocities, although the administration here in this country has justified the atrocities of Saddam Hussein over the years and has, in fact, even helped with some of those atrocities by pumping in aid of various sorts. But while I'm not condoning anything that's going on over there, I'm just sort of pointing a cautionary finger, saying, guys, it's a lot more complicated than you think. Another thing that's a bit more complicated is shortwave radio. A lot of people can't figure it out. The piece that we heard tonight was from The Voice of America, a newscast aimed at the rest of the world. In fact, we'll be hearing something else from The Voice of America very shortly. We also heard Waltzing Matilda from the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem, concert recorded in 1977. And The Clash before that with a twin song, The Call Up, and The Cool Out from an EP back in 1981. And we also heard some Mexican music up on top. I'd like to play a little bit more of that before we end the show tonight, because it's just such a pleasant kind of music to listen to. And it brings back good memories for me of my trip down to Baja California. And
the nice things that were happening before I got back here and found out about all the garbage that's going on. Anyway, we followed up the Mexican songs with a bit of Pink Floyd, Get Your Filthy Hands Off My Desert. And does anybody know where that that amazing dialogue about Yankee imperialists and the communist domino theory threat and all that, do you know where that came from? It came from a film came out in the 60s called The Ugly American. Definitely recommend seeing that film. It's a very good production. And that's where that dialogue came from. And speaking of shortwave radio, from today's New York Newsday, President George Bush, in a pep talk intended for American troops in the sweltering Persian Gulf, but apparently heard by few of them, said yesterday that because of the massive U.S. deployment, nobody's feeling the heat more than the Iraqi government of Saddam Hussein. In the speech broadcast over Armed Forces Radio from the Oval Office, Bush said the deployment of tens of thousands of ground troops, hundreds of warplanes, and scores of ships is proof the United States will do what it takes at any hour, anywhere, to contain aggression and keep freedom's light alive. Now, why was nobody listening? Well, officials acknowledge that because the radio network has no transmitter in Saudi Arabia, U.S. forces in the Desert Kingdom did not hear the live broadcast. Incredible. But they said it was heard by personnel aboard U.S. ships in the region and that transcripts and tapes would be distributed to units on the ground in Saudi Arabia within a week. Promise. In the five-minute talk, Bush expressed the nation's gratitude for the troops' sacrifices. "You're now in the middle of one of the toughest military missions in modern memory," he said. "Well, as tough as it is, know this. Thanks to you, nobody's feeling the heat more than the government in Baghdad." Bush added, "You stand on the front line against aggression and international lawlessness. We have never sought conflict, nor do we hope to chart a course for other nations, but at the hands of injustice in the face of aggression, ours is a once reluctant fist now clenched resolutely." Who is he, King Lear or something? God, what a sentence. Anyway, it is your presence, your skills, your talents, your judgment that bring America's principles to life and give them strength and meaning, Bush said before collapsing in a heap. Oh, boy. Amazing. Oh, I said one more thing, too. "Together with our allies, we will find the way to peace." And if we do find the way to peace, it's going to be because cooler heads will have prevailed. And, folks, I'm calling on the cooler heads to come out and be counted. Because there's nothing easier than joining nationalism and rallying around the flag and all that kind of thing. And it's real hard to stand up and be counted when your position isn't exactly popular. You know, and we need people who are not gung-ho to say things, to write things to newspapers. I'm starting to see, you know, a little bit of feedback finally, but the press has been so pathetic as far as their coverage of this particular event. It sounds like the voice of the administration. It really does. I mean, the voice of America is no worse than ABC News, and that should not be. The voice of America should be a lot worse as far as propaganda, because they're run by the government. But that's just not the way it has been. Not the way it has been at all. Now, technologically wise, let's take a look at what happens if you try to make a phone call to Iraq. That's something I've been trying over the last couple of weeks. And generally, you'll get the following recording. Actually, correction, this is making a phone call to Kuwait. Yeah, if we try making a phone call to Kuwait using AT&T, you will most likely get this message.
"Due to an emergency situation in the country you are calling, your call cannot be completed at this time."
I don't know if you can hear him. Listen carefully.
"Due to an emergency situation in the country you are calling, your call cannot be completed at this time."
Yes, apologies for the horrible sound quality there. That's my answering machine.
PM.
And a brief note of explanation there. You may notice that there's a little computerized voice that gives the time, and then you hear a beep in I believe, the right channel. It's a special kind of machine that allows you to skip forward certain messages, and the technology at work there allows you to do that.
Military experts are joining in opposition to the sale of AWACS spy planes and F-15 fighter accessories to Saudi Arabia. Admiral Stansfield Turner, former CIA director, questions how Saudi Arabia could repel a Soviet attack on its oil fields using the radar planes when, in his words, the Saudi regime isn't capable of handling elementary threats of insurrection. And the former chief of Air Force Intelligence, Major General George Keegan, says if Saudi Arabia is genuinely interested in protecting its oil fields, there's a simple answer.
Open up some bases in Saudi Arabia to American personnel and invite the United States to permanently deploy in base one or two wings of F-15s and give us full air logistics and transport access to that country so that we have resources, logistics, people, and assets in place that can be moved into action with a speed of light, so to speak.
American interests could easily be compromised, according to General Keegan, if revolution comes to Saudi Arabia, which he calls a feudal and despotic state.
I think it's in the cards, and I would expect this within the next very few years. So in any case, we risk the capture of this equipment and its total compromise to the Soviets or their client states.
The total military package, according to General Keegan, constitutes one of the most powerful offensive systems ever deployed for regional use. This is Bob Gibson.
This is WBAI New York, the only station in town with the guts to play Sinead O'Connor. Boy, what a lot of garbage going on with her, too. I mean, this is all related. Everything we're talking about this hour is related. And, you know, you'd never catch me playing Sinead O'Connor, not because I don't like her. I think she's very talented, but it's not really my style of music. But when you read the papers, you realize, you know, someone's got to take a stand. Someone's got to say something, you know, because this is insane. Listen to this. The newspaper today, there has been no let-up of angry reaction to Sinead O'Connor's snubbing of the Star-Spangled Banner at her concert last week in Holmdel, New Jersey. After the Irish pop singer refused to perform at the Garden State Arts Center unless officials agreed to pull the national anthem, she says she objects to any country's anthem being played at her concerts. More than a half dozen metropolitan area radio stations reacted to listeners' complaints by pulling O'Connor's records off the air. I've never been to a concert where they played the Star-Spangled Banner at the beginning. Is that some kind of a new thing? I mean, I haven't seen that. So I can certainly understand how somebody would feel uncomfortable having the Star-Spangled Banner played before their concert, you know? I mean, ball games is one thing, but concerts, I just can't see it somehow. But apparently a lot of people disagree, because yesterday, letters and business office faxes still were coming in continuously at WBLI-FM, which reaches about 300,000 Nassau and Suffolk listeners. Judging from the comments, one reason for the large negative reaction to O'Connor is the Middle East crisis, which has heightened a sense of patriotism. Well, that's wrong. It's not patriotism we're seeing here. It's stupidity and nationalism and all that kind of thing. WBLI publicist Colleen Foley said yesterday she didn't know of a single letter or call in O'Connor's favor. Program director Bill Terry began the station's boycott of the singer on Tuesday. Foley said, "We'll keep it up probably until the Middle East crisis is over." The correspondence has been so heavy, she said, that we've almost papered the lunchroom with it. People ask that we take her music off the air and that we play the Star-Spangled Banner instead, which we've done. I don't know, I feel like I'm living in a David Lynch film or something. It sure feels that way. Listen to this. Not a single letter or call in O'Connor's favor. Well, folks, I hadn't planned on doing this, but someone's got to do it, you know? Someone's got to take a stand here. Except I can't seem to figure out how to use the telephone. Okay, let's try it now. No, it still doesn't work. Okay, we're going to get a dial tone here. There it is. Okay, we've got a dial tone. And we're going to make a call. Yes, hi. Is this information for Long Island and vicinity? Okay, I need the telephone number for the request line at WBLI-FM. Thank you very much.
The number is 955-9254.
Oh, boy.
955-9254.
That's one of those 955 numbers that I've told you folks about. You don't get charged up the wazoo for that one, but it's still a bit strange. I'll explain the technocratics of that in just a few minutes. See if we can actually get through here to the superstar disc jockeys over at that radio station. Phone is ringing. It's kind of funny, actually. All these phones are ringing here, and I'm not picking them up, and I'm ringing another radio station, and they're not picking up. Well, we're going to keep this online, okay, and we're going to invite our listeners to call in now.
Hi, BLI.
Yes, hi. I'd like to make a request. Is that possible?
Yeah.
Okay. Is it possible to play any Sinead O'Connor?
I'll see what I can do.
Really? You'll play it?
I don't know if we can, though. I don't know. I think the records are banned.
Are they banned by the station or by the FCC or something?
I mean, I have no control over it. They're banned by the station.
Ah. Well, if you could just say that a vote of support came in, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, I'll let them know that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night. Of course, he does not know that many people heard that phone number, and hopefully many of our listeners will call up and also voice support, because someone's got to do something about this kind of nonsense. 516-955-9254. It's one station being absolutely moronic. And I'm sure there's many in New York City that are doing the same thing. Not a single vote in support. I can't believe that. I can't believe it at all. I'm sure we can turn that around and get her back on the radio all over the place. In New York, on Long Island, in Connecticut, wherever. Doesn't like the Star Spangled Banner sung before her concert, so run out of town on a rail, you know? I've seen everything, and it's just getting worse and worse. Our phone number is 279-3400, area code 212. Program is The Fifth Corner. This is Emmanuel Goldstein, and the radio station is WBAI in New York. Good morning.
Is Hello?
There? Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, hi. Shortwave radios. excuse me.
Come on, spit it out.
Spit it out. After last week or a couple weeks back, you tried to place a call through to Antarctica.
That was a while ago, yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, on your shortwave radios, 14.955 megahertz, and you'll be able to hear phone patches to Antarctica in progress. As a matter of fact, there's some on right now.
Oh, really? What's the frequency again?
14.955, and that is on upper sideband.
Upper sideband. Okay, I'm going to check that out. Do you need a really good antenna for that, or can anybody hear it?
No, they're coming in pretty strong here. Now, I do have a pretty good radio here, but it's coming in pretty strong, so who knows? A lot has to do with kind of like your local conditions. You know,
if you're drunk or something, you mean?
I'm sorry?
You mean your physical condition or something like that? Or?
No, local conditions like if you're, say, if you live next to a power plant.
That I see.
Generate a lot of noise.
Right. You know, well, that would hold true for any station, so.
Like that, yeah, this is true. But, of course, signals like this, it's going to be even tougher. I called and I talked to Curtis last night, and I told him this, but I'll tell your listeners and you. Of course, Radio Iraq is on daily. In English, on 13.660 megahertz.
Have you picked them up?
Oh, yeah, they come in very loud. You should have no trouble.
About what time of the day can you pick them up?
In the afternoon, from 4 till 6 local time in the afternoon.
4 to 6 our local time?
Our local time.
Okay.
Daily, they have 2 hours. They have news. The news comes on about a couple minutes after the top of the hour. And then they play music, and then they have some commentary after that. They've been playing Mott the Hoople's All the Young Dudes.
Oh, my God.
For Streisand on there. And
so that's 13.660 for that and 14.955 for private phone calls to Antarctica.
Right.
Okay. We'll pass that along. Thanks very much for calling in, and let's go to some more calls. Good evening. I hear my voice now.
No, you don't hear it now.
Oh, okay, good.
This is kind of a retro time. Sine being yanked off the air. I thought, stations had grown up, but I didn't.
Stations reflect what people want them to do, just like government, sort of.
Yeah, very much. But it's just a little bit. It's just a little bit mind tweaking. I don't buy the idea that not one phone call or fax or whatnot of support came in.
I don't think that's true. I think they probably did get support, but it doesn't make a good story if you say that you got support and it's not unanimous.
Yeah, it's like let's hunt down the dissenting votes or something. But I was thinking about that when I was walking down the street from work down in the village, and I came across this store which had a slightly amusing T-shirt. Which was a takeoff of the arachnophobia.
Uh-huh.
You probably don't know if you've seen it or not.
I haven't seen it, no.
Has a spider with Saddam's head on it, of course, and it says arachnophobia.
Well, I mean, all that kind of stuff is all in good fun, but when it starts turning to hate crimes and people being censored because of what they say and do...
That's very jingoistic, and this is for an excursion which has the thinnest of ideological veneers... of anything I can remember in history, and they've run pretty thin. But this is really the thinnest.
I mean, sure is.
This really has to do with, it's somebody else's oil, but our money. So That's pretty much what it, you know, what it boils down to. But of course, getting confused with the facts is, you know, is kind of a national pastime.
As long as you sing the lyrics to the Star Spangled Banner, it doesn't matter if you screw up the facts now and then.
Well, yeah, but the funny thing was, I was reading something somewhere that I think at Yankee Stadium not long ago, they were playing America the Beautiful, and people didn't know the words. It took them by surprise. Much better song.
Oh, it is a much better song, but I don't think very many people know the words to the Star-Spangled Banner either, and if they do, they certainly don't know the words to the second or third stanzas.
No, they don't. But
they don't even know they exist.
It's kind of... It's scary and screwy at the same time, because people obviously haven't grown up, and neither has our energy policy, but that's another story altogether. But it's very funny, people getting very very hopped up and saying, well, we can't let them do this to us. And I say, well, exactly what are they doing to us?
Well, you know, up until the point where they took hostages, there really was no aggressive action against the United States.
Well, that's the whole, the part was that we sort of like said, well, they can't do that over there, so we're going over there.
Right.
I think people kind of forget this whenever they say, well, they've got, you know, they've got Americans over there. I said, well, yeah, they do now. But,
right, and that's something that I think we should have realized was going to happen when we did go over there. So we've got a flash coming in from the State Department. I'm going to go to that right now.
Okay, in fact, I will let you go. I'd love to hear more of this.
Okay, thanks for calling. And yes, this is something that we got off the shortwave. Here it is right now.
The following is a message from the State Department for U.S. citizens in Kuwait. As you may know, Saddam Hussein has announced that he will allow foreign women and children to leave Iraq and Kuwait. The U.S. Embassy in Baghdad has received formal notification from the Iraqi government that women and children wanting to depart will need an exit permit. We are now trying to clarify the new procedures required to obtain these exit permits and any additional steps that must be taken in order for American citizens to depart. The U.S. government is preparing to evacuate American citizens as soon as this is allowed. You should continue to monitor the VOA for further instructions. As concerning our embassy in Kuwait, the Iraqi military are still at positions around the perimeter. U.S. citizens should communicate with the embassy by phone and should not attempt to go to the embassy compound. Anyone thinking about an overland journey out of Kuwait should plan carefully and be aware that Iraqi forces are under orders to round up anyone identified as an American citizen. Anyone considering the desert route should know that at least one person has died attempting to cross. There are also unconfirmed rumors that others may have died trying to cross. While there have been individuals who have been able to make the trip without incident in recent days, there can be no guarantee for the safety of those attempting to cross. We want you to know that you are in our hearts and minds. We are dedicated to securing the release of all Americans and seeing you reunited with your loved ones. This has been a message from the State Department for U.S. citizens in Kuwait.
And listeners to WBAI New York, who I'm sure that message was not intended for. Good evening, you're on the radio.
Hello?
How you doing?
Hi, I wanted to talk about the Sinead O'Connor thing.
Oh, hello?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead and make it quick, because we're running out of time.
Okay, I just wanted to say that I don't think it's right that they banned her song. If you look at other rock stars and other bands that's playing on, they don't play the national anthem before their concerts. I just would like to say that it's not fair.
Okay, thanks very much for calling. And it isn't fair. It certainly isn't, and I never have heard of the national anthem being played in front of people's concerts, unless it's, someone really old and patriotic, but, she's Irish, for God's sake, you know? It's not like she's American. Even if she was American, it doesn't give somebody the right to say, well, you have to play the national anthem when we tell you to, you know? It's garbage. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. It's good to hear you back. This is Eric Blair calling.
Hi, Eric. How are you?
Okay, good.
Good to
hear
your voice
again. What I'd like to say, however, is that, WBAI does not allow WBAI to be discussed on WBAI.
I've noticed that. It's a real problem. Good evening. Go ahead. Hello? Okay, well, you have to speak. That's the rule here. Good evening.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, how are you doing?
Okay, I'll make it quick. It's amazing that you got young men and women who may die over there in Iraq right now in our armed forces. You got a president over in Kennebunkport, a name I still can't even pronounce. You got the SNL, you got Alphonse the idiot, the model, talking about bombing people left and right, and all these idiots like Z-100s and these others can think about is Sinead O'Connor. And that thing with, you know, with the at her concert. I mean, that's ridiculous. Z-100, I want to say something about them and those other stations. They would have fit in real great back in the 1940s when they were saying such things that the propaganda is kick a Jap and slap a Jap and that sort of thing. They really and truly fall in with the lowest denominator.
Well, you have to tell them that, and we all do. It's very important that we get on the horn right away to do this. Okay?
You got it.
Stay angry. Thanks for calling. And that's going to pretty much do it tonight. We are here on WBAI in New York. The program has been The Fifth Corner. My name is Emmanuel Goldstein. I'll be back again in 2 weeks, God willing, and if the world is still here. And stay tuned now for Bob Fass, another quality radio program. Remember, folks, stay angry, stay alert, read the papers, and don't forget to write.
Don't be afraid of your freedom!
These are the Soup Dragons, Something New. Good night.
Free, do what I want, any old time.